You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at the Tour de France, brought to you by iWoka, flexible loans built for small businesses. iWoka.co.uk. Today we're in Paris.
Where are we, Lionel?
Well, we've made it to the Place de la Concorde on the final day of the Tour de France. It's very low key, isn't it, compared to normal in terms of the crowds, but everything else feels pretty much as it would be. All the team buses parked here. We can see the race just going past over there. And one of our audio diarists is in the break of four, Connor Swift.
We're in that situation again. Lionel wearing our DS hats. We've got a man in the break. How's he gonna win from here?
Well, he's up against...
he's not. I'm sorry to... Spoiler alert, he's not going to win from here. It's going to be a bunch sprint, I think.
Well, the time gap is only 15 seconds and there's 15 kilometres to go. You're right, he's not going to win from there, but let's not be defeatist, Richard. He's out front on the final day of his first ever Grand Tour, first ever Tour de France, of course, with the Olympic champion Greg Van Avermaet, with Max Schachmann of Bora Hansgrohe and Pierre-Luc Perrichon of Cofidis and...
Van Avermaet.
The big question is, où est François?
Well, François has... We're up at the Place de la Concorde where we always kind of camp. The buses are here. The riders will work their way back here once the stage finishes. François's gone up to the finish line, to the mix zone, to try and get some reaction from riders as they cross the line. We'll hope to include Connor Swift's thoughts on today's escape for him. A great way for him to end his debut tour. With, you know, off the front on the Champs-Élysées, that'll be a great experience for him, I'm sure. We hope to get his thoughts in this episode. We've got lots more in this episode. We've got a bit of a Slovenian package. We've got Jeroen Swart, the head of medical at UAE Team Emirates, talking about Tadej Pogacar. Very interesting stuff from Jeroen on Pogacar. And, I think we're still digesting, aren't we, what happened yesterday. And I guess much of this episode will be taken up by that.
I guess so, yeah. Well, there's two laps to go here. Let's see who wins the stage. Who's your money on?
My money is on Alexander Kristoff.
That would be amazing.
Or Mads Pedersen.
Oh yeah, you went Mads Pedersen yesterday, didn't you? Winning his final race in the rainbow jersey would be the perfect way to sign off as world champion before the World Championships next week in this balmy season of cycling. I will say that Sam Bennett will finish off and confirm, put beyond any doubt, the green jersey and become... Well, he's going to become the first green jersey winner from Ireland since Sean Kelly in 1989. It's looking very much that way because he scored best at the intermediate sprint. So I'll say Sam Bennett. Let's see, shall we?
Well, I know the break's been caught. For the four riders who were out in front for a long time have been caught. Who have we got in the front now? Kasper Asgreen. It's very much a De Kooning quick step lead out by the looks of things. Sam Bennett's up there in third, just behind Michael Morkov. But there's Mads Pedersen moving up. Oh, I meant to mention Elia Viviani as well earlier. He's there.
Well, into the final kilometre now. Sprint finish on the Champs-Élysées. I'm just going to stick with Sam Bennett. Are you sticking with Mads Pedersen? I think you should, because he's right in the thick of things there.
Sagan is kind of muscling his way through, but he's very much on his own, isn't he? No lead out man or anything for Sagan. Obviously trying to get maybe on Bennett's wheel, but here we come into the Champs-Élysées. Now we'll get the side-on shot. Here we go, there's Michael Morkov on the front. There's Jasper Stuyven just behind him. You can't really tell what's happening. Mads Pedersen's there, Sam Bennett, Viviani. Great letter from Stuyven. So much for the Richie Port lead-out. Where was that?
Bennett versus Bennett. Pedersen.
Bennett's going to do it.
He's
Bennett
it.
Has done it. What a way to win the green jersey.
Absolutely. As I said, first Irishman to win the green jersey since 1989. Sean Kelly and Sam Bennett, both from Carrick-on-Shore. I mean, what an incredible... And look, I mean, look what it means to him here.
Carrick-on-Shore, to be sure. I just heard an anecdote from Sean Kelly on the Eurosport commentary that he'd had a text message from Sam Bennett's mother saying that she didn't know which was more painful, labour or watching this. Well, she can rest easy now, because he won that pretty convincingly, didn't he? A length ahead of Stuyven with who's that coming up from Bora Hansgrohe? Well, there,
a length ahead of Pedersen.
Oh, I don't recognise Peter Sagan in his Bora Hansgrohe jersey.
No. There you go. Well, you don't recognise Mads Pedersen in his rainbow jersey.
No, I saw that he was second and Sagan third, I think. But, well, Bennett, he was emotional when he won in Ile de Ré, wasn't he? He'll be emotional now.
What an incredible tour for him. What an incredible journey, as he talked about. The long progression back to the Tour de France after a couple of very difficult tours for him earlier in his career. And he's come here, as we covered in our Kilometre Zero, in the high-pressure position of De Koninck Quickstep sprinter, and he has delivered two stage wins in the green jersey. The first time a Quickstep rider has won the green jersey since Tom Bonan in 2007, I think.
And that is a safe win if you're a sprinter. Let's go and try and speak to some people over the fence here and hook up again with Francois. Hopefully we'll find them.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWalker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWalker. If you run a small business, find out more at iwalker.co.uk. iwoca.co.uk.
Thank you very much indeed to iWalker, our title sponsor. If you have a small business and you'd like to find out what iWalker can do to help you, go to iwalker.co.uk. Lots of information there about the CBILS, that's the Coronavirus Business Interruption Loan Scheme, and also the ordinary loans that iWalker offer to help small businesses. iWalker.co.uk. Look who we found.
Loitering at a brasserie in the
Paris,
back streets.
Just in time to take us for dinner. Francois.
Yeah.
How did you get on up at the finish?
Well, I didn't get quite well, actually. It was the nice mix zone, probably one of the nicest I've been on this tour. Yeah, it was, the riders you can feel were relieved to have finished and were quite happy to talk. So, I talked to a number of not prominent riders in terms of, well, one of them held the yellow jersey, so it's not too bad. But I talked to three riders who I think left their imprint in one way or another on the tour.
They certainly did, yeah. I mean, let's hear first of all from Connor Swift, our diarist, of course. And incidentally, we've been collecting diary entries from all our diarists over the last few days, not been able to play them all. They will be gathered together in a Friends special that will be released later this week. That's available through the cyclingpodcast.com. If you sign up as a friend, we'll put together a nice little package of all the writers' audio diaries. I'm looking forward to hearing Michael Morkov's take on today's stage. He was a brilliant lead-out man once again for Sam Bennett. But Connor Swift played his part today. He was up the road.
Absolutely. He was up the road with Greg Van Avermaet. Who else were there? Max Charman. And there's one missing from my memory.
Pierre-Luc Perrichon.
Oh, Pierre-Luc Perrichon, that's right. Well, obviously, there's the usual doomed breakaway on the Champs-Élysées. But it was part of it, and it great fun, and that's what he told me.
Well, just thoughts on finishing the tour and being up front, on the Champs-Élysées. It must have been a great moment for you.
Yeah, definitely. It's my first Grand Tour, first Tour de France. Obviously, the team objectives with Nairo Quintana didn't really pan out. And these past few stages, we've had our own opportunities. I wanted to get in the breakaway the other day on a stage, but it didn't happen. But to be in the breakaway on the final stage on the Champs-Élysées is pretty special. I loved every minute.
What did you feel? Did you think you could go all the way with it was good guys in this break.
Yeah, there was good guys, but it was only a 20-second gap. Straight away, I knew it wasn't going to, stay to the line. There's loads of sprinter teams behind, but it's just the experience, and it's just good fun because I wouldn't have been able to get a result in the sprint anyway, so it was just a real good experience.
What would you say was your best memory of this tour?
Maybe today, or the time trial. I really enjoyed the time trial. Loads of crowds shouting my name, etc. So I've just loved every minute.
That was Connor Swift, and we'll hear more from him, of course, in his diary from today's stage. Who else did you speak to, Francois?
Well, then I came across Alexander Christoph, who won on the Champs-Élysées last year, and was actually the first winner of the Tour de France this tour, and the first yellow jersey holder. So, I mean, as such, he was an interesting rider to talk to, and on top of it, he is in the same team as pug. And so I asked him also, you know, what role as an experienced rider and a specialist of the flat, what role he played in the victory of Pogacar in this Tour de France. And this is what he had to say.
Thank you very much, Alex Christophe, for the Cycling Podcast. Alex, it was an amazing tour, I guess, for you. Yellow jersey on the first day, and then the team with Tadej winning the tour.
Yeah, it's been a fantastic tour. I started off really great, actually making the pressure for the team disappear, and everything from there on was bonus. But then Tadej was in such shape. We already said on the first rest day the goal must be to win the GC, because we saw how strong he was riding, and that he managed to finish it off yesterday, it's incredible. And yeah, this guy you're going to see a lot of from the future. He already won three stages here and the GC, so yeah, it's no words can describe how strong his ride in this tour was.
We saw you work for him a lot, actually, on the flat. I mean, you, how much did your experience help, do you think?
I try, of course, to contribute where I can, because in the climbs I cannot really contribute. But since we didn't have the leader jersey on the stages before, we got it yesterday, so we didn't need to work so much, like, for example, Jumbo. So for sure we feel a bit sorry how they lost it, but that's sport. And it's also, I think it's good for the sport, because Jumbo was a little bit riding like Ineos before, smashing everybody with a really strong team. And this year Tadej showed it's possible to beat these strong teams, and that makes also cycling more exciting to watch.
Today what was role, I suppose, was to look after Tadej, not to win the stage.
My goal today was to win the stage, but of course the team tried to help me a bit, but we also need to make sure Tadej comes safely. Actually, I had quite good legs, and I just came a little bit too far back into the final straight, but I think my speed was as good as the other guys, so I was maybe hesitating a little bit. Unfortunately, I waited a bit too long, and then the finish line came too fast, but that's life.
Well, it was Alexander Christophe, who, one of my tips for today's stage, you put in a bit of a late charge, but yeah, interesting to hear what he said about the, you know, that it's good for cycling that the dominant team hasn't produced the winner, and that a team can dominate the race in the way that Jumbo Visma have, but not ultimately win it. And you know, if there's one thing that keeps sport interesting, it's unpredictability, and that's got to be a positive thing from this tour. Predictably, a Frenchman didn't win the tour. That's always quite predictable. I'm sorry. But you did speak to the top-placed Frenchman as well.
Yeah, yes, I did, absolutely. Guillaume Martin, I was coming back to the buses to look for you guys, and I walked past the coffee this bus, and there was Guillaume Martin talking to his agent, good Philippe Rimbaud, and an old friend of mine who used to work with Jean-René Berdonneau when he launched his Bouygues Telecom teams and many others. And Guillaume was, a glass of champagne in his hand, and as I talked to him, this is what happened.
I'm with Guillaume Martin, and he's spilling his champagne cup on his jacket. So Guillaume, while celebrating your best result in the Tour de France, it was maybe not the result you were looking for, but it's not so bad.
No, sure, it's not. It's only one spot better than last year, but the way I achieved it is a way better. My feelings all along the tour were really good, and I was also straight in GC for a long time, and also I finished the race in a really good shape, so I can say I did a really better tour than the previous year, and I'm happy, and also it's full of promises for the next years.
First and second week you looked great, and then there was a crash. How did it affect? It seemed to affect you a bit, that crash.
It's not easy to say how much it affected me. Sure, it didn't help me, for sure. I think from the second week it was a lot of little things. This crash, also I had some mechanical problems, and all this together explained that I lost 1 minute there, 1 minute there, and at the end that's the difference between an 11th spot and 11th spot and the top 10.
Yeah, because at the beginning, I mean, you were up there, even attacking the Jumbo-Visma and Pogacar, you were up there with these guys, so there's no reason why you should not in the near future finish in the top 5 or even better.
Yeah, it was three also in GC of Critérium du Dauphiné with the same level. So I know now that I can target those results, and this is my level, and I will work for it and for sure look for it in the coming years.
So to sum this tour, to sum it up all together, disappointment or rather satisfaction?
No, I would say satisfaction. Of course, you have frustrations here and then, but mainly it's satisfaction.
You've been chasing Guillaume Martin for a few days, François, and we talked at the very beginning of the tour about what would represent progress for him this year, his first year with Cofidis. When you look at his Tour de France results, in 2017 he was 23rd, in 2018 he was 21st, 2019 he was 12th, this year he's 11th, so he's due another big leap forward next year, yeah, maybe 8 or 9 places.
That's what he talked about. That's what he's aiming for, probably. And of course, he's not as well known yet as Thibaut Pinot. I also talked quickly to Yvon Madieu, one of Pinot's team managers, who confirmed that Pinot really had gone all the way, especially to be yesterday in Mélisée and on the Champs-Mélisée, as some of our colleagues wrote, now Pinot is going to take a rest, and Madieu told me, and then he's going to the Vuelta looking for as a stage hunter, and we'll see. Who knows?
We were unnerved by the sight of the champagne bottle open outside the Cofidis bus, because famously they have a bottle of champagne in their fridge.
I think that was a different one, just for the VIPs rather than for the riders themselves.
Good. Well, listen. Sam Bennett is the toast of Carrick-on-Suir, of Ireland. I think it would have been enough of an achievement, really, to win the green jersey, but to win in the green jersey on the Champs-Élysées and to win that stage that really every sprinter wants to win,
which Sean Kelly never won, despite coming close a few times,
really puts a cherry on top, doesn't
Absolutely. It? Absolutely, yeah. Great result for him. And well, as I said at the beginning of the episode, another rider whose progression you can see, coming up in steps, like climbing the ladder, and this feels like the top of that ladder for him. When you think back to those two tours where he had a pretty miserable time in both, to one degree or another, and then the successes he's had at first the Giro, then the Vuelta, the disappointment of not being high enough up the pecking order at Bora Hansgrohe, and then getting the move. Do you remember this time last year we were talking about that wrangle to get him out of his situation at Bora Hansgrohe? They were claiming that they had an option on him for the next year. He was claiming he was free, and he's moved to De Koninck Quickstep. And as we said in that kilometre zero, it's not an ordinary sprint job, is it, in that team? You can't just say, well, second or third or fourth and say that's enough. It's victory or nothing. Patrick Lefebvre stalks the Tour de France like the boss of the team, doesn't he? And round at the De Koninck Quickstep bus this evening, they had the champagne open, and it was party time. And as I said, it's a huge thing for their team to win on the Champs-Élysées in the green jersey.
Huge pressure on him, and he's kind of rescued the Koenig Quicksteps Tour de France. Okay, Julian Alaphilippe won stage two, but otherwise is maybe a little bit disappointed with his tour, and Bennett has given them cause for celebration, I suppose.
Yeah, I think this win on top of it was his most convincing sprint win for a long time. There was no question at all that he would win it. He surged forward, perfectly set up and led out by Michael Morkov, as you said. And the thing, I believe, it's like we all often say strikers in football need confidence to score. And what happened in this stage, I think, the green jersey was mathematically not secured. But he scored points in the intermediate sprint. He actually won the bunch sprint at the intermediate sprint. And then it was it. He knew coming into the finish that the green jersey was definitely secure. And I think it probably lifted his confidence very much, and then all he had to do was to prove he was the fastest man in his Tour de France.
Over these last few days, he's actually been ahead of Sagan and Trentin, and at every kind of important point. He hasn't conceded any ground. He's just added another couple of points here, another couple of points there, and really gone about the job very methodically. He did actually say the other day, after he'd been in that break on stage 19, that, you know, it was almost a sort of half apology to his rivals that he'd ridden quite, you know, defensively, cleverly, sensibly. But that just shows that he was going about the job, you know, to get the green jersey secured. And, well, Peter Sagan effectively conceded it last night. I just wonder now, there's the Sean Kelly Sports Centre in Carrick-on-Shore. What are they going to name after Sam Bennett now? I don't know, maybe create a BMX track or some kind of cycle circuit, or...
I don't know, a flooring shop, you know, after his sponsor. But, you know, that's finish. I think it kind of suits Sam Bennett as well. The Champs-Élysées, you've got, you know, several goes at it to get your lines right and sort of practice it. And I always feel like he is the strongest, if not the fastest. And, you know, it's not as technical, because it's so such a fast finish, it's not quite as technical. It's quite, you know, wide roads, sweeping corners. And he doesn't get caught out, as he sometimes does, or he sometimes has done. I mean, you remember on stage one in particular, he kind of got caught out there. And I think, you know, we often see the strong guys winning this stage. And I think he is one of the stronger sprinters out there, along with, you know, Pedersen and Christoph and those sorts of guys. I mean, we didn't detail the etap tonight, Lionel, because... We were live commentating on the end of the stage, auditioning once again for the Rob Hatch, Ned Bolting.
I think those guys are
move
safe,
over,
aren't
guys. Yeah. We're coming for you. The other story today, I suppose, was the gesture of support that the riders made at the start of the stage, against racism was the sort of official line. And I think the intention was good, and certainly quite a lot of riders had face masks with the message on the face mask. From memory, Caleb Ewan, Wout van Aert, Michał Kwiatkowski were some of them. A couple of them spoke very eloquently about the subject, including Wout van Aert and Caleb Ewan. But the execution was a little bit disappointing. I mean, the idea was that Kevin Reyser was going to ride out through the start with, you know, in line with the jersey winners, and plus Mark Hershey, the most combative rider in the tour, and it was a little bit underwhelming. It didn't quite pan out the way that some might have hoped it would.
No, I think that's a fair comment, Rich, but something did happen and it caught the attention, and from what I gather, a lot of discussion has been going on behind the scenes for not just the last couple of days but for the last week about what the riders should do. I've seen a lot of people saying ASO should do this or the UCI should do that, and while I agree that probably the race organisers should do something and the governing body should do something, it's important to kind of remember that in professional football, the Premier League, and in the NBA basketball and the NFL, it's been the players that have taken the initiative, and that has forced the leagues to put their weight behind the move rather than the other way round. So I think the fact that some riders did something today was a step. It was a conversation starter. Now, that won't satisfy everybody, of course. Of course it won't. But from what I gather, there's been quite a lot of discussions between the riders, and the movers behind this today were TJ Van Garderen of EF Pro Cycling, Luke Rowe of Ineos Grenadiers, and Daryl Impey. I'm not saying that they are the only three at all, but they've been kind of coordinating the discussions on the WhatsApp group, which is which has been set up for the riders in each team who are part of the CPA, which is the riders' union. And I gather there was some debate about what to do at the start today, whether they should take their helmets off, and that was dismissed as an idea because that's what the peloton would do as a mark of respect if somebody died in a race, for example. And it came down to the riders choosing to do something that they were comfortable with, and so that's what we saw today. And well, I spoke to somebody today who said, you know, it's a start, it's the beginning of a conversation, and it is at least professional cycling acknowledging that there is an issue
that needs to be tackled and addressed. And I think the important thing is that there is a second step to this, and that there is further progress, and it isn't just we did something at the start of the last stage of the tour and kind of ticked that box and moved on. The pressure's got to be kept on to see what the next step would be. And I think listening to the people who were in our Kilometre Zero episode on Friday, the thing that struck me most was making cycling as a sport more inclusive for people that aren't white, basically.
Matt Rabin, who we had on the podcast a few weeks ago, Matt is black. He works as a chiropractor with EF Pro Cycling, one of the few black people working in professional cycling. He tweeted about it, saying, having been privy to some of the conversation on this gesture for the past week, I think the thought and gesture trajectory, difficult word to say, is the right one. Every journey starts with one footstep, said Matt.
I think there's a danger, isn't there, with all of these issues that we want progress to be as quick as possible, but it's not necessarily possible to jump from, point A to point Z in one go. At this time last year on the Tour de France, this wasn't even a discussion point at all. And I'm not saying that today was adequate in any way, but at least it is on the agenda and it's being talked about.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet interrupting our final episode from the 2020 Tour de France to remind us to tell you that it's sponsored by, as indeed all our Tour de France coverage, our nightly coverage, has been sponsored by the Watt Bike Atom. So it's time to say thank you to the next generation Watt Bike Atom, because it's powered us around France, I think we can say. Over the past 3 weeks, we've heard all about the new Atom, from the new improved features to the benefits experienced by some of the real-world Watt Bikers we've spoken to. In fact, we had a message on Instagram. I'll not say who it was from, because we may well be in touch, but this person messaged us to say, I'm a hip surgeon and bought and used a Watt Bike Atom during the COVID crisis to maintain fitness, sanity, both during lockdown and the madness which beset hospitals during that time. Happy to talk about it if it helps with the sponsorship slots. Well, not say your name at the moment, but we'll be in touch. That's great to hear. Thanks for reaching out to us, as they say, across the pond.
Well, it's interesting, Rich, because in a couple of our episodes, we did hear from people who've been recovering from quite serious operations or injury, using the Watt Bike to get back into exercise and building up their strength. And that's one of the things we've spoken about over the past 3 weeks. And we tried to highlight the improvements between the old Watt Bike Atom and the next generation, which is available now, including the new electromagnetic resistance system and the instant gear changes, which made it a very pleasant experience, particularly when riding on Zwift or RGT or any of the other platforms, which gave a real improved ride feel, better than ever. And the data that's being captured by the Watt Bike Atom is even more accurate than before. The Watt Bike connects up to all of the leading training and racing apps, and there are some extended trials with some of those apps when you buy a Watt Bike Atom. And of course, it looks great as well. So if you would like to try out the next generation Watt Bike Atom, it's available to buy now from £90 a month. See wattbike.com, that's wattbike.com, for details.
Well, chaps, we today have been, like everybody else, still digesting what happened yesterday and sort of mulling it over. We had some conversations in the car about it on our drive to Paris, didn't we? We were sort of speculating about what would have happened if, the gap had been narrower. Would Pogacar have gone out quite so aggressively? And did that unsettle...
You mean if the gap had been bigger?
Oh, sorry.
If the gap between Roglic and Pogacar had been a minute and 40, or 2 minutes...
I said this, wasn't it?
Yeah. You said that Pogacar wouldn't have gone out chasing it because he wouldn't have thought it was doable. The fact that it was just about within the realm of possibility meant that Pogacar could go out very aggressively with nothing to lose.
It was only possible with the most incredible performance, which he committed to from the moment he left the start house. Yes, absolutely. There's a lot of debate about whether Roglic had a bad day or not, and almost this idea that it's sort of insensitive or hurtful towards Roglic to say that he had a bad day when he finished fifth on the stage. But it's all relative. Mm-hmm. Relative to his level of performance the last 3 weeks, he had a bad day.
Even Chris Froome had a couple of bad days in the tours he won. But I mean, the gap he had made in, you know, previously was you know, good enough for him to keep out of trouble. And well, even Eddie Merckx said, you know, he thought Jumbo-Visma, well, to quote him exactly, said got what they bargained for, because he thought Merckx thought that they'd lost the tour, you know, early on, earlier in the tour than. And that you know, the time trial sensation was a result of their being overcautious. And they said, you know, rule one of cycling: never underestimate an opponent. And Merckx felt that in a way that underestimated Pogacar by thinking 57 seconds was enough. And when we discussed in the car, I agreed with the fact that we know why they did it, why they held back a little bit, you know, in the first and maybe the beginning of the second week, you know, trying to build their success progressively and fearing that maybe Roglic would fade a little bit in the third week like he did sometimes in the past. But that maybe, you know, maybe Pogacar could have been, you know, well, at least if not totally beaten, but at least, you know, put in at some distance in the first week.
There are two schools of thought, aren't there, in stage racing. Some people will tell you the race is won in the third week. Others will tell you you have to take time when you can.
Yeah.
And I think Jumbo-Visma, the mistake they made, I mean, it's easy to say this now. They came very close to winning the Tour. They might well have won the Tour. So I'm very wary of sort of, in, you know, applying hindsight here, but we
did make this point through the tour that they weren't capitalizing on the team's strength.
No, but I think the reason for that was that, you know, was the memory of Roglic at the Giro last year, and just it was sort of preserving Roglic, protecting him, making sure he didn't run out of gas again in the final week.
But once again, maybe the best protection would have been for him to have enough time, you know, on Pogacar to spend a reasonably relaxed third week.
And yet, as I learned from our friend Tony Gruden of the Slovenian national broadcaster, who we hear from quite a lot in the final part, during that Giro last year, Roglic caught an illness from Laurence Dupluis. Laurence Dupluis, remember.
And where did Laurence Dupluis catch that illness, Lionel?
I don't think he did catch that illness, although I did have a sniffle in Bologna at the start.
The theory here is you kept Laurence Dupluis at the top of the climb for a long time. You even insisted on doing an interview with him when he wanted to go. It was cold.
Yeah.
You kept him up there. And a few days later, he had a bit of a sniffle. You gave that to him. He got ill. He had to pull out. You cost Roglic the Giro.
Well, I don't think so, because Roglic also crashed and was suffering from some pretty hefty injuries as well, which they kept very quiet at the time.
Maybe he crashed because he was unwell.
Well, maybe. Well, should we hear from sports directors?
I put the question to Rod Ellingworth and Matt White. Rod Ellingworth from Bahrain McLaren, Matt White from Mitchelton Scott. Just asking them the two questions, you know, did they see yesterday coming? And what did Jumbo-Visma do wrong, or what could they have done differently?
I mean, Rod, did you see that coming yesterday?
I think we always knew it was not completely finished, but I wouldn't have thought he'd have done that ride. I mean, that was... you know, when you was watching the race and you started seeing that clock counting down, we were jumping around on the bus getting all excited. But I did think when he got to... Like, he lost 20 seconds. I thought, well, he's just controlling it. Surely he's just controlling it. But Roglic just didn't look right, did he? From the very, very outset, he didn't look good. So he had a shocker, didn't he?
What did Jumbo-Visma do wrong? What could they have done?
Do you know, I don't really know. It's easy to say. I mean, the guy's position looked strange on his TT bike. As soon as he sat down, I was like, strange. His head was high. He just didn't seem to be on it. Then when he changed bike, I think they made a bit of a mess with the change of bike, but he just didn't look good on the road bike, did he? And every other stage, he's looked absolutely solid. I don't know. I mean, you can never sort of tell, can you, if mentally he just broke down, you know? Who knows, did he not sleep at all the night before because he's that worried about it? And you could see that Pogacar was like, he was flying on the climbs, wasn't he, and taking time out of Roglic them last few mountain stages. So, you know, I guess,
what could they have done over the 3 weeks to give him a bigger buffer going to the race? Did they do anything wrong, you know, those other stages?
I don't think so, not really. I think they rode superbly, didn't they, as a team, but, you know, it wasn't to be, was it? That guy was just so flipping strong, wasn't he? You know, he didn't just beat him, he absolutely smashed him, didn't he?
What's Pogacar worth now?
I don't know, quite a lot, I'd say. God, hey, he's going to be a rich young lad, isn't he? Yeah, fair play to him. You know, hell of a talent.
Good question. Did you see that coming yesterday?
No, I did not. I did not. Look, he's class act, but Roddick looked pretty bulletproof. And I did. I think even if he'd lost the time trial, I didn't expect him to lose by that much. At the end of the day, he didn't have a bad day. He finished fifth, and not so far behind a former world time trial champion. So I did not see that coming at all.
What could Jumbo-Visma have done? Not just yesterday, but over the 3 weeks. What could they have done better?
Oh, look, I'm not one to criticise other teams' tactics, but I think Roddick obviously was very, very good early, and we never really saw him go on the offensive. And he's probably pretty content with, and they rode an incredible tour, and they had total control. But maybe if they had really put a cat amongst the pigeons on some of the early mountain stages, there might have been bigger gaps. We'll never know.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science in Sport for supporting us through another Grand Tour. How many Grand Tours is that in total? Quick maths.
2016 Giro through to I don't know. I don't know.
16, 17, 18, 19. 4 times 3 is 12.
I've just seen a rat run across the road.
A rat just ran towards your feet.
Wow.
Yeah. 12. Wow. 13. This is our 13th Grand Tour with Science and Sports support. Wow. Thank you, Science and Sport. And if you want to get 25% off your Science and Sport products, go to scienceandsport.com and enter the discount code Francois. SISCP25. You snooze, you lose. We're all a bit off. We're all a bit put off by the sight of that rat running towards us.
It's fine. It's gone underneath the area that
we're
sitting.
It was a big one.
It must have been using the
Science and Sport. It's had a few gels, hasn't it? Maybe a few of the duck and butter gels, descending gels that Science and Sport are rolling off the production line as we speak. Before we go on to talk about Pogacar a little bit more, we have been running our final Pedlar de Charme poll today. There's actually 13 minutes left in it as I speak, but I'm pretty confident Richie Port is going to be the winner ahead of Mark Hershey, Sam Bennett and Nielsen Paulus. 1,237 votes cast, and Richie Port has got 49% of the votes, which is pretty convincing. And I think people have enjoyed seeing Richie Port have his moment in the sun. It's he's in the grey jersey, obviously, as the first old boy. But you know, at a time when we're seeing all these young prodigies coming through, Richie Port finally getting his podium place
has
been a story that people have enjoyed
following.
To say
you finished on the podium in the Tour de France after, you know, the career he's had, where, you know, the expectation and the pressure and the, you know, the days when we thought, oh, Richie Port's in a really good position here, and then he's had some terrible moments, either his legs have let him down, or he had the horrendous descent, didn't he, down into Chambéry a few years ago. And the moments of disappointment have probably outweighed in the Tour de France, certainly, the moments of joy. And
it just shows you, doesn't it? Keep plugging away.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is the result that will be freshest in his memory, certainly for the foreseeable future. So
are you listening to us, Thibaut?
Yeah.
Well, he was on the podium already.
Isn't that fascinating? Because I do think, you know, the weight of the world is on Pinot at times. And when you saw the climb yesterday and the crowd that was out for him in the times of COVID, you know, a reduced crowd, just imagine what that would have been like if Pinot had been in the mix for the podium or the stage win. But sometimes he does look like he's got too much pressure on his shoulders. And he was going so well at the Dauphiné, and then...
Well, maybe he can aim for the grey jersey. We'll see.
We'll see. So we'll get that lovely Pedlar de Charme mug from Stacey Snyder sent to Richie Port. She's also going to make a mug for Primoz Roglic, because he deserves one. Somebody on Twitter said, when we ran the poll yesterday to find the finalists, said, we all know who deserves a Pedlar de Charme mug, but we also know that it'll go straight out the window as soon as he gets it.
Who's just that?
Roglic. Wow. Just as a consolation for going so close to winning the Tour.
Yeah.
It doesn't really maybe cut it as nice as the mugs are, but I'm not so sure about that either. I think the last 24 hours we've seen a side of Roglic that we didn't know, which is human.
Yeah, even on the rollout in the long neutralized section today, you know, he was, I mean, better man than me. He was smiling, he was chatting to Pogacar and others, and the disappointment must be absolutely cutting him to the core, and yet he was able to kind of, you know, I'm not saying put it on for the cameras at all, because I don't necessarily know whether that's the case, but I'd be bereft after yesterday. It was there. It was in his hand. All he had to do was close his fingers around the Tour de France, and it was his. And it'll be one of the stories of the next couple of seasons. Does he recover from this? Does he come back next year?
I mean, think about Laurent Fignon. You know, did Fignon ever really recover from going so close in 89?
As you said yesterday, though, Rich, Fignon had won two tours before. You know, Roglic has suffered the kind of the Fignon effect. Without,
I'll tell you what, it's a bit like Cadel Evans in a way. I mean, you know, he went close numerous times, but he kept plugging away, and eventually got there.
The one thing in Roglic's favour, I think, is, you know, relatively few miles on the clock. You know, kilometres.
He's got
on
a
the
good
clock.
Few years
so
left.
Exactly. Could have a few
Fignon
years.
Fignon was what was on the way. Well, 1989 was his last good year, and then he was on the way down. And I think Roglic has still got a little bit, you know, at least three or four seasons ahead of him.
Yeah.
But is that one of the reasons why he was on the way down after that, is the question. Anyway, on with the Pogacar chat, because I was just looking at Fignon's age. How old was he in 89?
28, I think.
He was only... 20,
I think he was only 28.
29,
right, 29. Okay.
He was 29.
But, yeah. I, you know, this is the weird paradox of modern cycling. You can go later and you can also be younger. I mean, you know, in 1989, you didn't get many 21, 22-year-olds at the sharp end, and you didn't get many 34, 35-year-olds at the sharp end. And the sport has kind of extended. It's just a case of whether, you know, I still think you maybe get a 10, 12-year window. It's just where you start and where you finish.
One of our friends on Facebook, Richard Mason, he's a member of our Facebook discussion group, said that every Tour de France is a retrospective work of art. And that's a great phrase.
Well, funnily enough, that is a Fignon concept. Fignon talked about how you work out how the Tour de France was won at the end, and you work back. And he talked about that many times in his commentary.
This is what's so interesting, and it sort of chimes with what Alexander Kristoff was saying. There's been a way to win the Tour, hasn't there? Established over the last 10 years by Sky Ineos. And that's what Jumbo-Visma copied but took on. And that's been shattered this year.
But to give you credit, Rich, you've said for a long time, it doesn't matter if you've got the strongest team if you don't have the strongest rider when it counts.
I agree with that. I agree with myself. But I think you can also beat the strongest rider if you have the strongest team.
Yes, you
can. And I think that's where maybe... And we chatted a bit to Rod Ellingworth after the interview there, where we talked about the different permutations, what they might have done differently. And the one thing we all agreed on was, in the original concept of the Jumbo-Visma team, Steven Kruiswijk, Tom Dumoulin, Primoz Roglic were going to be three kind of sort of leaders, but not so much leaders, but options. And very quickly in this race, they deprived themselves of what, because Kruiswijk missed the race on having broken his collarbone. They came in with Dumoulin and Roglic as two options, and Dumoulin took himself out of the equation.
But do you not think that the whole concept of the Tour de France is that when people get to the finish of any big stage, they're often thinking, fantastic, I made a bit, or I didn't lose much. It's quite as the expectations are quite narrow. How often would a rider get to the finish and go, oh, I didn't make enough there? Because they're absolutely knackered. They've made as much as they can make. Yeah. You know, there won't have been a day when Roglic got back to the hotel and thought, oh, I could have taken another 30 seconds there.
As we discussed last night, that Dumoulin blew up his own chances. And it might have had the right outcome, but it didn't.
The best proof that teamwork is not enough, you know, to win the Tour is that the best team in the Tour again this year was Movistar. They won the team classification for the fourth time in five Tours.
Well, you can't argue with that.
No, you can't.
I can't argue with that.
They're amazing.
We're, you know, one of the interesting things about Pogacar taking the jersey so late is that we haven't spoken about him at all. He's a Tour
well,
de France winner.
How many Tour de France winners have worn one yellow jersey?
Some.
Well, we talked about it in the 1947.
Yeah, Jean Robic. Jean Robic is one.
Yeah. He was one who took it on the final day. He took it on the final.
Yeah, on the final.
Day.
He took it on the final.
So he
day.
Didn't wear it.
Didn't
at all.
Wear it at all. Jan Janssen.
Jan Janssen also. Herman Van Springer and 1968. Herman Van Springer was Herman Van Springer was fancied to win it.
Yeah.
And Janssen beat him in time trial, I think. And
that was 68, wasn't
68,
it?
68, yeah. Absolutely.
I can't remember too many others. I'm sure there are. Someone will correct me.
Cadel Evans, when he won it, took it very late. I mean, in the last time trial, not the last. Yeah, I think that was the same. It took a
couple of days.
A couple of days before the finish.
He did, you're right, yeah. And I remember it was the same thing with Cadel Evans, where, you know, suddenly, you know, you had him before you, having not had the opportunity to ask him anything all race, pretty much. Mm. We've been talking about Pogacar today, obviously, and one of the results that stands out for Pogacar is the Tour de l'Avenir. He won that in 2018, the Tour of the Future, as it's known. Egan Bernal won the Tour de l'Avenir in 2017, so a bit of a trend developing here. But I spoke to the rider who finished second to Pogacar, Timon Arensman, who now rides for Sunweb. He is a year younger than Pogacar, and a great prospect as well. Here's what he remembers of that Tour de l'Avenir in 2018.
Yeah, I didn't knew him, but really surprised me in a good way in that race.
I mean, what was he like as an opponent, and when in the race did you become aware that he was the sort of number one guy?
He was also just not he wasn't on the front of the race like that year. Ivan Sosa was also competing, so, and he won some really big races, I think Burgos maybe, against the pros, and he was the big favorite. But in the end, in the mountains, you just saw Brendan McNulty, Ivan Sosa, and Pogacar, and then me. Just, we're climbing really well. And in the end, Pogacar just took on one stage 1.5 minutes on us, on the big group of favorites. And there he just made his GC win. He was just not like on the forefront, not the big favorite, but he was just really climbing well and also really smart in his attack, I guess, on a really good moment. It was really smart and, it was just really good.
Did you get to know him at all that week?
No, I don't think I really spoke to him. I think he was also then like he looks like now on the TV, like a really nice and not like a really loud guy, just a really nice guy and doing his own thing. And I think he was also like that. So he didn't, in my opinion, he didn't really change.
What's it been like for you? I mean, you've just turned professional with Sunweb. What's it been like for you to watch him, you know, win the Tour de France this year?
that's amazing. That makes me also a bit proud that I was the first guy behind him in Tour de l'Avenir, of course. And I'm really really surprised and how he made such a big step forward and. I just hope that I also can do that in a bit more years.
So that was Timon Arensman. Look out for him. He's part of that very successful Sunweb team, and he's a great prospect, and second to Pogacar at the Tour de l'Avenir.
Well, quite an indicator, isn't it, the Tour de l'Avenir in recent years. When you go back through the recent winners, Pogacar, Bernal, Godu, Soler, Miguel Angel Lopez, Ruben Fernandez, Warren Barguil, Esteban Chavez, Nairo Quintana, Roman Sikar, Jan Bakalens, Bauke Mollema.
You could go on.
All the way back.
The names that were mentioned by Arensman there, as well as Pogacar, Ivan Sosa was another one who was up there in 2018. So, but bring it up to the present day. I also spoke today to the head of medical at Team UAE Emirates, Jeroen Swart. Now, Jeroen Swart is, as well as a medical doctor, an exercise physiologist, and he has worked for many years also in anti-doping in South Africa. I first met him a few years ago when he was a scientist overseeing some lab tests on Chris Froome to determine his VO2, among other things. Now, some people thought that there was some kind of link between Swart and Froome. Actually, they'd never met before that day in London when the tests were conducted. Swart, as I say, is now the head doctor at UAE Team Emirates. So, you know, a lot of questions about Pogacar, as there are about anybody who wins the Tour de France. Can we believe in him? You know, he's the youngest winner of the Tour in over a century. He's a phenomenon, clearly, but can people believe in what they're seeing? There's no better person to answer that question than Jeroen Swart.
Hello, Richard.
Hey, Jeroen, how are you?
I'm excellent, thank you.
Feeling pretty good.
Of course, of course.
Did you see that coming yesterday?
To be honest, no. I was expecting him to attack in the mountains on, you know, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. I didn't think he had enough in him to win by enough of a margin to take the Tour. I mean, obviously, there's a combination of him doing really well, and I think once Roglic started to lose time, he seemed to get completely flustered and lose his rhythm and to some extent blew up quite dramatically. I mean, he still had a great performance, fifth in the TT, but in relative terms, it was an underperformance. So I didn't expect both things to happen concurrently, and that's the beauty of sport.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I remember bumping into you on the Vuelta last year on the penultimate day in the morning, and Pogacar did a very similar thing that day, you know, in terms of performance. I remember you saying that his powers of recovery were, it was his first Grand Tour, obviously, but you were really surprised just how well he was still recovering and performing that deep into the race.
Yeah, that's one of his greatest attributes is, and obviously there are many of them, but one of his defining attributes is his ability to recover. And that's really what differentiates winners of one-day races or short-stage races versus the winners of Grand Tours that we've seen in the past. And my colleague Inigo San Milan actually did a metabolomic study on the guys in our team. And, that's looking at markers of for various physiological processes. And Tade's markers are absolutely off the charts in terms of his ability to recover. So it's not just a practical observation. There's also a scientific observation in terms of his blood values in metabolomic assessment. So metabolomics is looking at the various different molecules that are involved in different biochemical processes in the body. And so he's really one of a kind in that respect.
We
saw that yesterday.
Yeah, you've worked with lots of athletes, obviously. Have you ever encountered anybody like him? I mean, it's funny because you're the doctor of the team. You're not the coach. You're not the physiologist. How does that affect the relationship you have with him? And clearly, you're aware of his qualities as an athlete. But how does he compare also with other athletes you've worked with?
Yeah, I mean, as you point out, I'm the head of medical, and my role with regards to Tade is purely keeping him healthy, and so. I happen to go to the bigger races, the Dauphiné and the Tour de France and the Vuelta last year. So I get, in that respect, I've gotten to know him well as an individual. But I also have access to a lot of his data. And, some of the aspects that I'm involved with in the team are that fall under my department are things like load monitoring to prevent the athletes from doing too much. So there's certain physiological tests that they do, and we look at blood parameters and so forth to make sure that everybody stays healthy and doesn't end up overdoing it, whether it's training too hard or not eating enough or so forth. So I have quite a lot of insight into his physiology as well, and as well as his personality, having gotten to know him. So he's certainly a very unique individual in terms of, and some of the key things that I've picked up is his incredible maturity for someone who's 21 years old. He turns 22 on Monday. Mm. The racing maturity that he has in the Tour de France and previously also in the Vuelta. Last year in the Vuelta, when he lost time to Miguel Angel Lopez and lost his position on the podium with a few stages to go, you know, some even older athletes would become, you know, very despondent or negative. And he came back onto the bus immediately after the stage, when you'd expect someone sometimes to maybe have a little bit of an outburst. But he was completely and utterly in control and sort of shrugged it off and said, you know, everybody has a bad day. We'll see how we go tomorrow. And true as Bob, 2 days later, he went and stole back that place on the podium with an audacious attack on the second last day. And so it's not just the physiological side. Personality wise, he's absolutely got the makings of a champion, which he's shown.
Mm, and yet he's just a kid from Slovenia, as he described himself last night.
Yeah.
In a very endearing moment. He seems very down to earth. I mean, you know better than anybody that the question people will have is, can we believe in him? And I guess there's nobody better placed than you to reassure people on that. I mean, that comes with winning the Tour de France. I guess the two questions. One is, you know, is he prepared for that sort of scrutiny? Because we've seen how that scrutiny can affect people. But also, you know, you presumably wouldn't, you know, you wouldn't be in the position you're in if you didn't believe in him.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't get involved in any aspect of this team if I wasn't sure that my reputation was safe. And my one of the roles that I have as the head of medical is also to scrutinize the blood values of all the riders, and we have an internal monitoring system which, you know, we obviously get all the data from the CADF that does their own controls, but we also do our own independent controls, and we're not afraid to act on those, as you saw last year in the Giro. You know, we took the unprecedented step of removing somebody from a Grand Tour because we weren't entirely comfortable with their blood values. And later on, we were, through a series of physiological studies, able to show that they were normal physiological variation. But that's the level we're going to make sure that, you know, everything is above board. And obviously, I have access to all of the blood profiles, and there's nothing that I've seen that makes me even remotely concerned. Tade is also someone who shies away from using any medication whatsoever. I mean, last year in the Vuelta, when he crashed, I could see he was in pain, and I offered him paracetamol, and he refused to take paracetamol. He said, "No, the pain's not bad enough to warrant taking any medication. I don't put anything in my body that I don't need." And so, you know, those sorts of things give me a lot of reassurance. We know the history of the sport. I mean, you can never be 100% sure of anything, as we've seen over the years. But certainly from what I can see and control and what I have seen, there's nothing that gives me any pause whatsoever.
I mean, it must be interesting for you, just from a kind of a scientific point of view as well, that you're working so closely with a Tour de France winner. And, you know, not many people get to do that, I suppose, and it must be a fascinating thing to experience and to see just what it takes physiologically, but also, I guess, mentally as well.
Yeah, I've been very privileged in that I've had the opportunity to work with three Tour de France winners, from Jan Ulrich back in 2006 through Chris Froome and now with Tade. And so I've got quite a lot of data on what it takes to be a Tour de France winner. And I mean, it's always incredible, having been an athlete at you know, a relatively high level in cycling, knowing how absolutely unbeatable I would feel when I was in the best shape of my life, and then looking at those numbers and comparing them to what these guys can do, it's humbling, and you realize how absolutely incredibly talented they are.
Mm. I mean, you mentioned Ulrich and Froome. Where does Tade compare? I mean, you know, what is he going to carry on improving? I guess you don't know that, but you know, where does he stand physiologically compared to those two?
Well, you know, that's a very good question. We've got a guy who's, you know, only 21 years old. We know that cyclists reach their zenith in their mid to late 20s. He's still developing. I mean, we've seen how he's improved since the Tour of Spain last year to now. Is he at the best he can be? Logic would say no. But the question is how good an athlete is he going to become then? And what is his ultimate potential?
Well, there we are, Rich. The winner of the 2020 Tour de France, Tadej Pogacar, was born in September 1998. It's his birthday tomorrow. I remember the day he was born, not because I knew Pogacar was born, but because Jose Maria Jimenez won a stage of the Vuelta, a mountain stage of the Vuelta, a day I remember as if it was yesterday, because I was in the Cycling Weekly office watching it on TV. And that's kind of oddly, I mean, for me, you know, he's only been alive as long as I've been working in cycling. It's shook me, that, really, to be honest. Anyway, back in February, I travelled to Slovenia to interview Jani Brakovic, who until Primož Roglič was Slovenia's highest placed rider in the Tour de France. He was ninth. And while I was there, I met Tony Gruden, who's a journalist for the national broadcaster in Slovenia. He very kindly bought me a beer. And a couple of days ago, I repaid him with a coffee and an ice cream at a brasserie in Bourg-en-Bresse. So that will be on the tour, on the cycling podcast expenses, Richard. Sorry about that.
That'd be good, this.
Now, at the time, it seemed almost certain that the first Slovenian tour champion would be Primož Roglič. Of course, we didn't know that it wouldn't turn out that way. But I wanted to know whether Pog and Rog mania had captured Slovenia.
It's euphoria. It's like a Slovenian would have won Wimbledon. It's the biggest individual success of Slovenian athlete on the global stage, in the global sport. We have quite a lot of champions in winter sports, Tina Maze in alpenskiing, in ski jumping, Peter Projec, Primož Peterka, who won the World Cups together. Tomaso would know them, but there are niche sports for a few countries, for 5 to 10. In cycling, it's more global, it's more widespread. You have now, in the last 10 years, you have a winner of tour from Australia and so on, from Africa, if you count it, Froome as a half African product of cycling. So, yeah, you saw on the streets, on the hilltops of the Tour de France, there are many Slovenians now, even with the COVID crisis.
So a lot of Slovenians have come to support Primož and Tadej?
Quite a lot. To Paris, they're coming with two planes, so around 400 to 500, even a few buses with the cars. I don't know how it will get. I know that in Champs-Élysées, there will be restriction to 5,000 people. So we'll see if the all Slovenians could come to Champs-Élysées. But you saw on the Grand Colombier that Slovenians are quite, they knew how to get it to hilltops even when the whole mountain is closed.
I also asked Tony what lockdown was like in Slovenia, and he said that restrictions had been less tight than they were in Italy, Spain and France, and that the riders could do more or less the training that they wanted.
As you know it, it's quite easy. If you make a 200Ks or around, you go through half of Slovenia.
If you remember, Rich, Pogacar was in the UAE at the UAE Tour when the coronavirus crisis first hit cycling. In fact, he won the uphill finish at Hebel Hafit, which was the last stage before the race was stopped, and the whole race went into lockdown, and some riders, including Pogacar's teammate Fernando Gaviria, were put into isolation. The riders got back to Europe. Pogacar went back to Monaco, where he lives, as does Primož Roglič, and when it became clear that the lockdown in France was going to be quite serious, they went back to Slovenia, where they could train a bit more freely. Neither of them rode particularly hard, I gather. They just kind of ticked over. They did a sort of winter training block until it was confirmed that the racing would resume on a particular date. And that's when Pogacar stepped it up, and he was going so well that apparently towards the end of July he was told by his team to take a week's holiday just in case he overdid it. I think other than Luxembourg, Slovenia would be the smallest country by population to have a Tour de France champion.
Yeah, but if you would compare with a pro cyclist or maybe even a registered cyclist, It would be, I presume it's smaller than Luxembourg, because Luxembourg has a long, long history. The youngest ever tour winner is from Luxembourg, if I remember correctly. We are saying that we don't understand really how this is possible. It's coincidence, because it's not a national program. We didn't have like in Britain a British Academy or Slovenian Academy. It's two quite totally different ways to the top.
Now, confusingly, POG was discovered by the ROG Cycling Club in Ljubljana. Tadej Pogacar's brother, Tilan, was already cycling, and when Tadej was an 8 or 9 year old, he was itching to get involved in cycling, and the ROG Cycling Club visited his school, and all the kids did a 2-minute test on a static bike. And the cycling club weren't just looking for the most talented, they were also looking for the riders who tried the hardest. And apparently Pogacar caught the eye, because he really put everything into the effort that he made.
Yeah, it's a now very known story when he went to one race for the children's, and he saw one the peloton, and one guy was falling a lot of time back. And he said to the organizers why they don't put him out of misery, if you can say it. And they were saying, no, he was overlapping now. He will in half a lap, he will overtake him. So them. So he's astonished. I see, I mean, it's 11 years old, with the 13 years old, with 2 years older guys, yeah?
So the question now is, what next for Slovenian cycling?
We got... only last year, our first operative velodrome in Novo Mesto. It will make a huge difference, because Slovenia didn't have that school of velodrome, which is very important for sprinters, for all the phases of the development, also for the winter training. But it's a really good velodrome. The Italians are coming there, Ghana, Viviani, and so on. It's a quite a coincidence. A lot of people are taking their bikes out, even before COVID. Now with COVID is another push to another. We are getting government or local, especially local investments in infrastructure with the cycling paths, ways. They are now promising with the long distance path. So it will develop. I already said I'm at Team Pog, because maybe for selfish reasons, because Rock is 30, 31, he will be, Rock is 22 next week, so we will enjoy with him for 10, 15 years more. So now, it's you get more answers for today, that's true.
Well, as Tony said in our conversation, Pogacar's from quite a humble, typically Slovenian background, lived in a small village when he was growing up. His mum's a French teacher at high school. Dad's a furniture maker. And now Pogacar's girlfriend is Urška Žiga, a pro rider for the Ali BTC Ljubljana Pro Team. And she recently finished 78th in the Giro Rosa. And, the Ljubljana women's team is a pretty big deal in women's cycling. And I think the men's teams are kind of playing catch-up a bit there.
Yeah, fascinating to hear a bit more about Pogacar and where he's come from. We'll learn a lot more, I guess. And I got the feeling last night at his press conference that his personality is going to come out. He's a sort of typically quite shy 21-year-old. The other question we were all asking ourselves today in the car was, what would we have been like at 21?
Bloody hell.
Press conference like last night. You know, I mean... Oh, you know, he's got a lot growing up to do. His talent belies his youth, doesn't it? And he will, over the next few years, mature. And I think he'll become... you can see there's a personality in there that's going to come out and develop over the next few years.
Richard, you were on the podium at the University Cycling Road Race Championships when you were about 21, so probably you're the best 20. Equipped to tell us.
There's no press conference there. Very good, though. I like it. Nice one. Well, listen, we're coming to the end of our Tour de France. It's been strange but fun, hasn't it?
It has been strange, hasn't it, in some ways. I mean, when you came back from the buses, having talked to Tom Southam of EF Pro Cycling and said that the Bink Bank Tour starts on Friday at the same time as the World Championships, I was just like, what kind of dimension have we stepped into here?
It
doesn't feel right, does it?
Yeah, Matt White's sort of preparing to go to the Giro. You know, see you in Palermo, he said. Well,
and,
I don't know.
And there's a bit of a problem there as well, because, I mean, the classics, as you know, are coming up, and there are restrictions in Belgium for some people coming from abroad, notably France and Spain. And apparently there's an agreement for the riders to come and race, which is not a problem because it's all been set up already. But for mechanics and some of the staff members, it's going to be a problem because to get to Belgium, if you're in a green area, in a green zone in any other country, you have to go on quarantine before. So for some of the teams, the schedule, if it goes ahead as planned, because we never know, you know, we live in day by day, could be also hampered by the restrictions in some countries.
I must admit, I'm quite looking forward to my 14-day tour de quarantine at home.
A bit of Zwifting for you, Lionel.
I will be. Do something. Yeah, absolutely.
I think it's a great achievement, you have to say, for the Tour de France to run in the way it has. I think there have been moments along the way where we've been looking through the cracks in our fingers at the crowds and the way some of the crowds have been behaving, including yesterday on La Planche des Belles Filles. And I think, you know, some people will look at that and really think that that's not been very sensible.
Do you not also think that the tensity of the bubble has kind of been relaxed a bit this evening, hasn't it?
Yeah, it feels like it has relaxed.
If you look at a Champions League, you know, football, it looked, because the format had changed, like a COVID Champions League, probably the US Open with no crowds at all also looked like a COVID US Open tennis. But this Tour de France looked more or less like a proper, almost normal Tour de France. And I mean, sports-wise, it was one of the best we've seen in many years. So, yeah, unexpectedly good.
I want to read something else out from Facebook. Stacey Snyder, our ceramicist friend, wrote that she always feels a little sad on the last day of the Tour or any Grand Tour. A friend and fellow cycling enthusiast told me yesterday that the French word malaise originated to describe the feeling you have after a great cycling event ends. Is this correct, Francois?
Well, not really, but I mean, why not?
I don't think Stacey really believes that. But no, incredible. And we talked a bit about the 89 Tour last night, didn't we, and the comparisons with that. There was a lovely post from Greg LeMond of him and his wife, Kathy, watching the finish yesterday, getting really caught up on it. He says, I always believe that my wife's excitement that I have watched over and over, because there's footage of her watching him come in at the finish in Paris after I won in 89, was because I was her husband. As you can see, it had nothing to do with me, because she gets just as excited watching Pogacar and Roglic battle yesterday's stage. We have a few thank yous.
We do.
We're going to say some thank yous to friends of the podcast as well, but some big thank yous to Iwoka, our title sponsor, to Science and Sport, and to Watt Bike, who have been advertising in the podcast throughout this Tour de France, as he did last Tour de France. Thank you also to Zwift for sponsoring our Kilometre Zero series. Very grateful indeed to them. A new sponsor for us, and it's been great to be able to deliver 15 episodes of Kilometre Zero.
And a big thank you to our producers, who every night get the episodes out as quickly as they can. John Mooney and Tom Wally have focused mainly on the regular episodes, and Adam Bowie and Will Jones are the guys behind Kilometre Zero. And a big thank you also to Jonathan Rowe, who has kept everything going on the social media front.
A big thank you to David Luxton, Rebecca Winfield and Nick Walters, who all help us very much to run things behind the scenes. Thanks also to Greg at Divine Cellars, who's curated the wine collections, the Cycling Podcast wine collections for this Tour de France. We've been enjoying his wine, and you can still purchase it at divinecellars.com. Thanks also very much to Skoda for the loan of the beautiful Kodiaq VRS car Particularly thanks to Lisa Kirkbright at Skoda for arranging that. Thank you.
And a big thank you to Stacey Snyder for creating the mugs and enabling us to give a gift to each of our audio diarists from the Tour de France. And they have been Connor Swift, Michael Moorcock, Lucas Postelberger, Simon Geschke, Sam Bewley, Jens Kukalera, Pavel Sivakov, Tom Southam, Nikias Arndt and Ryan Gibbon. Thank you very much for all your contributions. You've taken us inside the race in a year when it's been pretty challenging to get close enough to the bubble.
And the sales of Stacey's mugs has raised, I believe, about $3,500 for the Pitchoun and the Joyriders in London. So that's great news. We'll get a final figure on that later on. Thanks to Tom Carey, who's been great company for us at the Tour, Telegraph cycling correspondent. We've been travelling with him a little bit. And a huge thanks to Francois.
Oh. Well, thanks to you guys. It really feels like the end of the Tour, because we're here in the Brasserie. They're closing down and taking away the furniture. We will be finishing this podcast standing.
In a hurry. Yeah,
Where are you taking us for dinner? Where are you taking us for dinner tonight, Francois?
We're going chez Flot. It's a classic brasserie near Place de la Concorde. If you're in the area, go chez Flot. It's one of the, you know, you can't go wrong with Flot. It's a traditional Auvergne stuff, and yeah, you'll be pleased. It's always been good from, you know, for many years, and it's never budged. So go. Well, we're going there anyway.
Well, our reservation's in 3 minutes. Should we worry about that?
Well, no. It closes down at midnight and takes orders until 11. So it should be all right.
Well, maybe I still have to do a bit of a Sam Bennett across a few blocks, maybe.
Well, will you be my Michael Moorcock?
Always, Richard. Always happy to be your Michael Moorcock.
I think Moorcock. I'm more of a Tim DeClercq, haven't I, really?
Big unit on the front.
The tractor. Well, listen, thanks very much, both of you, and thanks very much, everybody, for listening again to the podcast. Before we go, for a final time from this 2020 Tour de France, big thanks to some friends of the podcast. From me, big thanks to Edward Morgan, Richard Tuxworth, Ariane Dykstra, Richard Dennis, Harry Walton, and Andrew Prelvitz.
And a big thanks from me for Christopher Close, James Forrest, Dr. G.P. Anticott, I think it is, Patrick McMurtry, Derek Adams, and Ronald Pullerman.
And a big thank you to Chris Wheatley, Sean Gordon, Miss H.L. Stapley, Alex Britton, Michael Fletcher, and Rich Hoey. And thank you very much, Richard, for your company and leadership during the 2020 Tour de France for the Cycling Podcast.
Finally, before we go, we will have Lizzie Banks' audio diary from the Giro Rosa coming out later this week as this month's Cycling Podcast Femina. It's going to be really good. Lots of interesting stuff in there. And we'll also, as I said earlier, be releasing the final installment of the Riders' Diaries from this Tour de France this week as well. And we'll be back to talk about the World Championships.
The World Championships and then the Giro and all the classics and then the Vuelta, and then we'll all have a nice lie down.
Exactly. Thank you.